Cool.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think we might make a start then. Hi, I'm Ruben. I'll be moderating today. Our first speaker this morning is Alexander Adelaar, and he's going to talk about problems in reviving
Syria.
So, thanks, Alex.
Thank you very much. Syria is a dormant language, or almost dormant language at the moment, in southwest Taiwan. In the 17th century, Dutch missionaries did a concerted effort to use Syria for missionary purposes, like they translated the Gospel of Matthew into Syria and also a catechism, and they prepared a word list and did a few other very small things in the Syria language. There might be much more Syria stuff somewhere in the world in an archive, but no one knows about that. And so this is the basis for, that is part of the Syria material that we have. There's also some word lists that were collected by the Japanese, which are very difficult to interpret and a little bit all over the place. And there are land contracts that were drawn between the 17th and the 19th century, which are bilingual Chinese Syria. What I'm going to tell you today is based on this, on the missionaries materials from the 17th century. I just finished the grammar of Syria on the basis of these, with the word list or lexicon and texts. And in the meantime, the Syria community has become very active and has made a dictionary of 900 pages and all kinds of very good looking teaching materials that also should, can be implemented in high schools and things in schools. And very recently, another CD with Syria music. When you, this is a grammar of Syria. How do you implement that if you have a community that doesn't speak the language anymore but is very willing to speak the language? It turns out that you have to make a few decisions. For instance, in the orthography, for instance, some phonemic distinctions were lost. In one case, we can retrieve that. For instance, the schwa was obviously there in Syria, but the orthography doesn't indicate it or indicates it with other vowels. And so you can reason back and look at the languages around Syria. They all have a schwa in the places where Syria does funny things. And second, the phonotactics of Syria is heavily influenced by the fact that sometimes a vowel is missing, and that is then the schwa. So schwa is phonemic, but ignored in the spelling. You can see that if the certain words have either a short e or a short u, and that alternates almost freely in some words, in other words it doesn't. But anyway, if you then look at the comparative linguistic evidence, you see that there was a schwa. That tells you there was probably a schwa here, but the missionaries didn't indicate the schwa. Why didn't they indicate the schwa? Because in Dutch orthography you don't have a schwa, like in English orthography, of course. They didn't think in terms of schwa, basically. On page two, you see a few consonant clusters which are rather rather awkward and a little bit un-Austronesian, t'bung, whereas actually Proto-Austronesian has t'bung, or t'bung. Here you know also that phonotactically, most words should be more or less CV, CV, C. That also counts more or less for Syria. And in a few words with where you find clusters like the four here, then chances are great that schwa was not indicated. You can also find a schwa in endings. You've got many endings. Austronesian languages have voice endings and other morphology suffixes, which are un and un are two very important suffixes, one with the schwa, the other with a. In Syria, you find un, in, un, without anything. And basically, there is quite a bit of overkill there. In and un alternate again. So basically, there's a schwa there again. This schwa can then be reconstructed, or can be, resuscitated. Basically, you can sort of in the phonemic spelling there should be a schwa in that suffix. In the case of in, un, and apostrophe n, you know that there was a schwa. In the case of an, there might have been a schwa. The word might have ended in an a and then have en suffixed, where the schwa was then dropped. Or in another case, there was really a suffix an and it was a locative suffix and it had another meaning than the suffix en, schwa en, which is object voice instead of locative voice. Sorry, mix my terminology sometimes. Usually mean the same thing. But, so what do? Do you follow the orthography and try to be authentic? Or do you follow the real structure of the language and try to be authentic at another level? If you follow the orthography, because that's what you found and that's what the what was inherited, basically, that's the material that we have today, then you run into spelling inconsistency and you are not really faithful to the structure of the language. If you go with the phonemic structure, then you get a more regular system. It's more natural. But you have to manipulate the orthography and you might be in for quite a bit of reworking. So that is a choice that you have to make. So language engineering is one of your options here. So that is one problem you will run into. Another problem is the voice system. I already mentioned it. Proto-Austronesian simplified had four voices, an actor voice, and then an object voice, but also a locative voice, and a number four voice, which is sometimes labeled instrument voice and other times recipient voice. The signifiers are still extant in Syria. They still exist. Trouble is that they don't do what they should be doing. You've got actor voice and object voice, and you see that these suffixes are used almost randomly. And one of our colleagues, Tsuchida in Japan, concluded that the system still existed, but it was used randomly. What I'm saying is the system did not exist anymore. The signifiers were still there, but there was a realignment going on where the object focus indicative of the object voice, the suffix indicating the original object voice in the indicative was combined with the locative voice suffix of the subjunctive, and together they formed a new system. So there was a realignment which was, logically speaking, shouldn't have happened, but basically the other suffixes are not used anymore. They're still used, but they're almost lexicalized, and you find them in certain verbs still use them, other verbs alternate. But what you really see all the time is that un and au, which don't belong together, are being used together on all kinds of verbs, and there's a regular pattern developing there. Tsuchida is, of course, not wrong when he says that there is a bit of random use of these suffixes, and the examples on page 3 tell you that. You've got examples like number 1 and number 2, for instance, sentences that are almost the same. But in one, you've got Nipaki Valet without a suffix. And in number two, you've got Nipaki Valayen with the object suffix. Why is that? I don't know. Someone didn't do his work well, these great male missionaries. Between 3 and 4, you see sentences that are almost the same, alternation between un and an. Ataralun, forgiven, and ataralan, also forgiven in almost the same in sentences that have almost exactly the same pattern. And then again, veutau for object voice for to bind, and in the same sentence you find the verb te, which is object voice with the original locative voice suffix, and then both in subjunctive. They're found within the same sentence and in phrases that have rather the same structure, and it goes on like that. The other examples are for your own perusal. On page 4, you then see why I think that there is a realignment going on. An is not only a verbal suffix, but it's also a nominal and a numeral suffix. Well, if it's a nominal suffix, it's always an, and there is no variation with an. If it's a numeral suffix, you find an, palatalized an, but no an. So the schwa an variant doesn't apply there at all. One in 50 cases does, but anyway, that's, you're working with an old text with little mistakes in it. Feature nouns do have an in most of the cases. If you have an, and there's a little bit of variation, but here the an is coming, is much more frequent and much more regular than en. So what you actually see is that this un business, which is so unstable, that happens in verbs and in the voice system, but it doesn't really happen anywhere else. Also, collective un as a collective suffix, for instance, asu dog, asu asuan, always un, never un. Vatu stone, vatu vatuan, stony places, collections of stones, never un, always un. So all the combinations do exist, although some hardly ever exist, but what you really see very often is un and au. Un and I come back very often and seem to become regularized, and the other patterns are being lost. So I think that, I think that there was a realignment going on. Now, the question, especially to the CIA people who are working on this, what do you do? Do you stay with the original Proto-Austronesian system? And many linguists in Taiwan do that, or used to do that. They would sort of think in an Austronesian pattern and then look for the signifiers and say, yep, it's there. Or do they really go for the system that exists and that is developing, and they sort of, all those signifiers, part of them, we acknowledge that these are actually on the way out, and there is a new system developing. I would personally go for the second possibility, because you get a realigned, simplified system that really works, that is easier to teach, and is more faithful to what really happened. And I think that actually, in the materials that were developed by Edgar Macapili, who walks away now, this merger was already taking place. All right, so I skip the bottom of page 5, I go to page 6. Now, this is a straightforward case that many of us have at this conference, I think. The vocabulary belongs to two different dialects. Many consonants look different. Or, in one case, you have a consonant, a velar fricative, r, whereas in the other dialect, the r was lost. And not lost without leaving a trace, because the vowels around it became palatalized. A became e, and u became l. Now what you get is, also with d, in one dialect, the Utrecht manuscript, because that's the only source that we have for that, have an s in certain words. The corresponding words in the Gospel dialect, in which the Gospel of St. Matthew was translated, have a D in initial, or D or R in initial position, and an R in medial or final position. So what you, phonetically, there was probably a D which generated both a D and an R in one dialect and an S, or a D in another dialect. What are you going to use? In the case of of the velar fricative and zero, it becomes much more pressing to find an answer and to know what you do, because here the vowels around it have palatalized, and you get cases where you really get different shapes of words, and also the phonotactics of the words in the Gospel dialect, which lost the velar fricative, was really affected by this. So you've got cases like, you've got palatalization wherever there was originally a velar fricative in the word. You can see that in number one, pasana, here, perenech in the other dialect, pulach, pulech. In final position, the velar fricative is still maintained, but it has that palatalizing effect. But in initial and in medial position, it was lost. That palatalization of e and u, which goes along with the loss of g, of the velar fricative, is seen across morpheme boundaries. For instance, uah living and ma uah in the Utrecht manuscript dialect, the UM dialect, would be ma uah, but that becomes meweh in Gospel dialect, and so on. Now, if you look at number seven, page seven, you see that there are all kinds of forms which change brother a lot because of the loss of the velar fricative. You can have a look for yourself, but look at a form like house, a village, town, which is Ruma, straightforward Austronesian phonotactic shape, related to Malay, Ruma, house. But then in the Gospel dialect, you get Elma. You've got Mucho for will, becomes Mewel in the other dialect, which is regular, but you have to look twice before you recognize the connection. Muchach, to live, becomes Mewek. I was wrong when I just quoted before. Vahu, new, Vehel in the Gospel dialect. So you get different form, different phonotactics, and what do you do in such a case? There are two vocabularies. One belongs to the Gospel, the other belongs to the word list in the Utrecht manuscript. Do you throw them together? You need all these words, otherwise you can't build the language. Do you throw them all together? Well, if you do so, you get doublets. Well, I already listed a few doublets here. There's no use in doing that, right? Another thing is you get a phonotactically messy word picture. The phonotactics of the language all of a sudden becomes, messy, of course. You get diphthongs where they were not in the original Siraya, or they were also not in proto-Siraya. You get palatalized vowels where originally there was only a four-vowel system. And you don't know when they turn up, when they come up. There's also another problem, and that is actually maybe structurally a bit more interesting. But look at what you find here on your page, in the middle of the page. You've got roots that are found in both dialects, but then have their dialect phonemic differences, of course. Now, these roots occur in derivations. Now, how do you put a paradigm? The paradigmatic relationship between various derivations from historically the same root will get blurred. That's basically what you get. I mean, you've got words that are essentially the same, that a couple of hundred years before they were written up were probably the same. They end up in different derivations. These derivations are part of the same system. But since the roots are so different, you can't see the connection anymore. And basically that affects the grammar of the language. It's a sort of artificial irregularity that you're adding. And I think that's no good. I would personally either reconstruct a proto-Siraya, but then you have to rework the whole vocab, or I would take one of the two dialects, and I wouldn't really know which one in this case. I would take the Utrecht manuscript dialect, because it's the most conservative and the most regular, and I would adapt the vocab of the Gospel to it. Okay, but that's something that you are faced with and that you have to decide on. But I think that you already know what your decisions are and why you do it. Anticipating sequences. Well, you've got complex you have complex verb constructions in Siraya, consisting of a auxiliary that is an open class, the auxiliary, everything can be an auxiliary, and which is followed by the infinitive. The auxiliary sometimes gets a phonetic chunk of the verb prefixed to it. So you've got on page 8, you've got kmita, that is kita. Kita is to look, to watch. Kmita is the actor voice derivation. Now, in this case, you've got dum, that means dark and secret. And if you say kmidum kmita, you are actually saying looking in the dark, see in secret. So here you see that the first syllable of kmita is prefixed to the auxiliary. You get kmidum kmita. In the next example, you see that there's a verb mumcha, which is actor voice prefix with umcha to understand. That becomes mumcha, and then you get all in front of it, and all, the word all is, or what is it, the notion all becomes the auxiliary, is the meaning of the auxiliary here. So, and the auxiliary gets all the marking, as you can see. Muimet kamu kawam mumcha ki ata. Do you understand all this? And here we see that the mu, the first syllable, which really runs through morpheme boundaries and everything, is prefixed to the auxiliary. You've got that a lot in Siraya. You've got that even more, I think, in Bunun. You've got it in a few other languages. I think Tao has it, right?
No, it doesn't.
Oh,
is it? On auxiliaries, I don't think so.
Oh, okay. There are a few very related phenomena which are not quite there, but but Bunun, Siraya, and one other language in the area, I think one of the Tsuik languages has it. And what is really typical is that it does not occur in all forms of Siraya. It doesn't occur in the Utrecht manuscript. It only occurs in the Gospel. Okay. And that in Bunun you've got one dialect that has a lot of them and another dialect that hardly has any of them. The way these prefixes are applied is a little bit random, and there's a bit of a choice sometimes that you can see reflected in the Bible text. Therefore, I think it's not really an essential core part of the grammar, and I think there is a choice to be made here. So, since there is a lot of irregularity and there is a lot of opaque meanings, very unclear meanings, you might as well either regularize the system, use those prefixes that are always regular and always have the same meaning and are very recognizable, and drop all the rest. Or you do what the Utrecht manuscript does, you drop them all. Or you keep them all, and then you are in trouble because it's quite a bit of work here. There are about 35 of them in the Gospel text, and some of them are absolutely not clear, others are very transparent. So yeah, what is my conclusion about this? I'm from, basically I started in Indonesian linguistics, and language engineering is a dirty word for Indonesianists. We have learned to hate that, we have been taught to hate that, it's certainly not something self-respecting linguist would do, but in this case I think it's really imperative that language engineering has to be done, that you have to interfere in the grammar and in what you see, and that you have to regularize it and make it applicable. So thank you very much.
Well, thanks Alex for that, very taking us through a lot of the complexities of the issues facing vitalization. I'm sure that we'll have some questions for Alex, given that we have some people in the room here.
So the issue is really sort of purity versus a tool for identity, right? That's really, I mean, this came up yesterday in Andrew Garrett's talk, and there was on Yurok in Northern California. There was a member of the Yurok community who stood up and went on for some time talking about how the community ideally would like to speak like the ancestors did. You know, like the older generation, grandparents' generation or earlier. The problem is, rather than like the language has become after contact, the problem is that's sort of a bottomless pit, you know? I mean, how far back do you go in terms of speaking like the ancestors did? And that's sort of what you're touching on here. Because as you go back, you find there are different dialects, and if you want to unify them, you've got to go back to Proto-Syria, and then what are you speaking, a proto-language? It really gets to be, I mean, what you really, I think what the community is probably most interested in is a mark of identity, personal identity, cultural identity.
But the community has already decided on that and has already made these practical decisions, I think, in some cases.
Yeah.
But maybe you can.
May I add that in addition to purity and identity marker, there is also practicality.
Of course.
Right? Because we need to know what the people can learn. The people in Taiwan nowadays cannot do L.
Yeah.
So we take away the palatalized L. We took it away.
Right. Well, I worked on Thao, and I know that none of the Taiwanese workers who went with me could pronounce the word Thao. It was always Sao for them.
Comments?
I wonder, with this sort of language engineering work, if you've ever had somebody say, oh, you just make, in a language reclamation context, particularly when there are political and social identity issues motivating the movement to some extent, has anybody ever challenged you saying, oh, you're just making stuff up to prove a point, and what you're doing is not legitimate, it's not real language? Have you ever encountered that attitude?
No, but my work is not such that they will say that. But
yeah.
I think that you got that a lot. And sometimes there is a bit of politics involved.
Or from other indigenous groups who perhaps still do have their language, do you ever get that attitude?
Well, I try to stick to the text. I only do what the text tells me to do. And then
yeah.
I do a bit of reconstruction, but that's all.
Yeah.
But you are applying this, right?
Yeah.
And this is the next talk, basically.
They sometimes receive criticism from some other groups for political reasons, mostly.
And it's always the same criticism, like, oh, you are inventing words, or you are taking words from Cebuano. Whereas actually, if you look at the history of European, Eastern European languages, I mean, it's replete with cases where languages have been relaxified, and no one remembers it today.
Mm-hmm.
So Romanian, Czech.
That's right. Yeah, you have applies to the same. Yeah, the same situation actually.
Even Italian to some extent.
I think what we are trying to do here, the very principle that we are trying to do is to restore, at first is the identity, right? And then restore that language, not the 17th century language, but that language retaining the vocabs, considering the present Syria, because I'm not a linguistics person, okay? Retaining
the vocab and most of the grammar, but make the phonology more acceptable to the
more acceptable,
speakers.
More acceptable
doable.
To the
doable.
The speakers actually,
because
they're all sinicized, and some of these sounds actually they cannot produce because it's not present in the Taiwanese sounds that they are speaking now. So we need some kind of compromise to do that.
When I started out doing this work, I was absolutely not, I didn't know about the Taiwan situation. I come from historical linguistics, and I found this a very important element. And we needed this language to know what it looked like in order to use it for all kinds of historical purposes. It's only later, to my great shame, that I discovered that you started your initiatives after I had begun with my historical work. Only later on we came together and worked together. It's from the 2002 onwards, I think.
2002.
Yeah, 2002. And I have been a bit slow in backing you up.
And thank you for helping us for the analysis.
Well, quick question. You touched on this a bit, but I was wondering how far did you go with sort of engineering the language? You talked about using Proto-Austronesian, comparing the manuscripts to Proto-Austronesian. Did you have to look to neighboring speech communities to when we're engineering language?
Well, I'm doing a text analysis like religious people do text analysis on Sanskrit and Hebrew and things like that, right? And on Aramaic. So I see what I find, and I know that there is something phonemic going on which is not expressed by the text, so I will explicitize that, and that's what my book is about. I explain what I see. I go to the neighboring languages to see, to be 100% sure, yes, but that's all I do. But the real language engineering is, of course, on a practical level. And I'm stepping out of my own philological tradition now, and I'm talking about language engineering. This is the first time that I do that.
We've got time for one more question. Let's see if there's any other ones. Otherwise, well, thank you, Alex.